Parkcast, the UK's original theme park podcast.
Welcome back to Parkcast, park fans. We're a podcast for theme park fans. We're here every week. We chat to interesting people who work in the theme park world and just have a general chat about theme parks sometimes as well. If you're new, I'm Bex. Lovely to meet you. You're very welcome to stick around, especially if you're a bit of a theme park nerd. We're all nerds here. And I'm joined this week by a theme park creative, someone who does a very exciting job in the world of theme parks, has got loads of experience in it. It's a job that I think a lot of us would love to be doing and love to know a little bit more about. So lovely to be chatting to him. Mark Lofthouse, welcome to Parkcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited.
It's so good to get you here. I was chatting to you a bit last year and we've been trying to get you on since, and we've just finally managed to make the time work and you're here now. So I've got loads of questions for you, loads of things that I want to know about what you do. Most people listening to this, I guess, haven't heard of you, but you've been behind a lot of things that we will have seen, especially recently. So we're going to get digging into that. But you do essentially a creative job in the theme park industry. That sounds like a dream come true to a lot of people. I guess it's a dream come true for you.
Yeah, the way you opened it as well, I'm a massive theme park geek. That is the entire reason that I am in this industry. I often kind of wake up pinching myself every single day. It's such a really cool space to be in. And I'm very, very, very fortunate that I kind of found my way in when I did. I'm 18 years ago this year, so I kind of found my way in super young. I kind of worked my way up very much from the beginning and from kind of the bottom of the career ladder, so to speak. So I just worked as hard as I possibly could do to get kind of where I am now, and I'm working on some super cool projects with the nicest clients, and it's kind of a really fun way to work because I do the theme park creative things. And then I also have another side, which is the entertainment side of it. So I do the kind of physical ride layout, spatial areas, spatial coordination, all of that kind of stuff. But I actually get to work on the things that live and breathe live with performers as well. So I've got these kind of two hats that work really well simultaneously.
Yes, you really are doing all the fun stuff, the ride hardware and some of the entertainment stuff. I know you've done a lot with scare mazes as well. So we'll talk about that, with it being the time of year that it is. But you say you're a theme park nerd. So are you genuinely one of us? Were you on like internet forums and things like that? Obviously, that wasn't really the TikTok theme park content that there is now 18 years ago. But where were you getting your fix of theme parks from?
100%. I was on Towers Times, Towers Nerd, I was on Coaster Force. Yeah. I was on, like, we're talking 2005 and 6. I was on the forums. I am legit theme park geek.
Okay. What got you obsessed with them?
So I do talk about this quite often as well with friends of mine who are like, why are you working in theme parks? Like, isn't that for kids? We get that quite often. No, it's not. So when I was, it does go back to when I was a child. So when I was young, I was really, really fortunate that I had, my dad loves theme parks as well. So I, since being a young age, I've always kind of been to parks, been to seaside amusement parks, been to theme parks. And then the kind of real eye-opening moment, I was super young, maybe 6 or 7, I've still got really vivid memories, but we went to Florida on a kind of family holiday, and it was extended family that went. I think it was about 10 of us that went. It was a really amazing time, and even at 5 or 6, I've still got such vivid memories of walking into Universal Studios at the time, which was kind of the one thing that's resounding with me. Walking into Universal Studios, like, we're talking before Islands of Adventure was even a thing, like, really long time ago. And I remember walking in and just feeling something. And I was only 5 or 6, right? I didn't know what it was. I was just having a fun time. But actually, when I look back, I was getting such like a deep emotional connection with being in a theme park environment. And now, especially when I look back at kind of my career, I've always lived to create, especially when I've got older, create that feeling for younger generations as well, right? I love developing ideas. I love creating things that actually, when they open, you look at families and children coming off with the biggest smiles on their faces.
Yeah.
Or sometimes screaming and crying with the horror stuff that I do, which is a different story entirely.
That's me, yeah.
That's like my vice to get away from the nice things. So I think the reason I'm kind of involved in the industry is just because I love being able to see firsthand that same feeling that I had as a child and were doing that for other people, it's such a heartwarming thing to be able to do. And you don't get that in a lot of other opportunities. Theatre, you get the same thing. And it's just an amazing, I think it's an amazing thing to be part of, and be able to do that for other people is just, yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, you're not the first person to say that on this podcast. John Maudley said something very similar. And he said the thing that he loved, obviously he'd worked in films, is with a theme park, is you get the immediate reaction. Like if you stand at the exit of an attraction that you've worked on, you can literally get live feedback on how that's gone down with people, which I guess is something you've managed over your time.
Yeah, I also love the fact that everyone has a different interpretation, right? It's a bit like film critics, where everyone has a different viewpoint on what they want to do. But I think why I love theme parks is what terrifies one person is the most thrilling thing to another person. And actually being able to have that in your mindset of when you're designing an attraction, and actually having these different kind of pinch points along the way and learning points, and how are we audibly telling the story, how are we visually telling the story? And I think for me that's the exciting part, because actually we have to have a look at a wide demographic and a wide kind of psyche of audiences and build all of that into one single brief and one single attraction. And I find that really exciting to be able to do. So I think for me 100% I'm with John on that. Being able to actually just see the reaction for people is just it's incredible.
Do you think that you have a bit more pressure on yourself because you are a theme park fan nerd? Obviously, you know what enthusiasts generally think about things. Do you have to extract yourself from the enthusiast mindset sometimes and just go, no, but this has got to be general public appeal, not just what I know my mates are going to like in the enthusiast world?
110%. I think the difficulty is you are your own worst enemy, right? Like you will always want to do something better or want something bigger, but at the end of the day, it's not about us, it's not about the enthusiasts, it's actually about what the client wants. Is the client brief? Is it hitting the demographics? Now, a lot of people that I spoke to who want to get into creating theme parks say, yeah, but I love being in theme parks, I love creating things and I want to design things because I know what I like. That's fine, but you're not paying the bills of the park, right? So I think there's a big part of it where you have to take yourself out of the situation and say, is what I'm designing a personal project? Is it something that I'm going to be like, yeah, look at everything that I've created? It shouldn't ever be that. It should be down to the client to say, actually, this is hitting the demographics because they've spent millions of pounds on these products, right? It's got to work for them. Mm-hmm. And without naming some attractions, we've seen it in the past where people have kind of either done it as a passion project, or they've done something that they think is going to really resound with the audience, and it just hasn't been a hit. And the reason that is because they've been so focused and had the blinders on about the end product being what they want to create. They've not thought about the most important part, which is the audience going to the parks and the client that you're working with. So I think for me, it's the first thing you have to do is go, okay, take a step back. This is super exciting that I'm working on it, but take a step back and then actually reassess the situation and go, actually, how should I tackle this with all of these things in mind?
Yeah, and I can imagine that is the difficult thing, because as enthusiasts, and you know, you are one of us, you've been one of us, we often think we know best, and we're like, why don't they just do this? And obviously there are always a million reasons why things can't just be done sometimes, but yeah, it must be a weird dilemma to be kind of sat in the middle of that. So would you say, even when you were at school, you thought, I need to work in that industry? Or did you kind of fall into it accidentally? Or were you very like, no, tunnel visioned, I've got to get into it?
I knew I was going to be part of it and I just didn't know how. I was always that really weird kid, right? And I was the weird kid who was like into horror films. I was into theatre. I was obsessed with theme parks. And I always knew I was going to do something in the industry. I just didn't know what. I kind of got my break really weirdly. And it comes on to the horror things that we were discussing earlier, but I got my break as a scare actor. That's kind of my weird way into the industry. And actually you find a lot of people have either come in through the entertainment or being a character performer. They kind of worked their way up that way. But I got involved with Scare Mazes when I was super young. So I was 16 as a scare actor for the first time. At a stately home in Liverpool. It wasn't even at a theme park. But the company that I worked for at the time ended up doing a lot of theme park work, and we're talking many years ago now. So there wasn't a lot of producers of that form of entertainment out there. So the theme parks had to kind of use who was there. And we ended up doing quite a lot of quite a lot of different products for theme parks, including all we worked over Europe, worked in Greece and Portugal and a few other places. And I was really fortunate that I kind of the owner of the company saw something in me, and he knew I kind of had that like eagerness to learn. So I started to work with him a little bit more on the design process. And then by the age I was sort of 20, 21, I was the deputy creative director of that company. So I was kind of leading the creative process under his guidance. And I got him to thank for so many learning points that I've had in my life. And that's kind of my way in the industry. And then I kind of went, oh, I'm doing horror all the time. I want to do something different. And that's how all the rest of it came into play. But yeah, I knew I was going to be involved. Just no idea how. I got in through a fluke.
What, do you know what? Again, you're not the first person to say that, and there are many people, including many senior managers who've been on this podcast, who say, oh, I was lucky, I was just the right place, right time. And I always say to them, and I'll say it to you, you weren't lucky. You knew exactly what you wanted, and you just went and got it. And yes, there can be an element of there was a job available at a time, but I think for you to make it in this industry, you absolutely have to prove your worth, and the passion is something that will get you a long way in this industry. It's not going to just fall in your lap. Like, you do have to really push yourself forward and say, no, I'm going to do this, and actually say that I can do it, and there might be other people who want it, but no one wants it more than me. So I'm going to
Honestly,
make it happen.
you've hit the nail on the head. And I think for me in this industry, it's super competitive, right? I'm going to be very open about that. I think especially from a creative standpoint, there is so much incredible talent out there. It's an incredibly competitive industry, and it's not necessarily about finding opportunity out there. It's making your own opportunity out there in this industry for me. And it's not necessarily being reactive to job adverts that are out there. You need to be getting in touch with people saying, look, I know my stuff and I want to do it for you. So let me just come and do it for you. It's about finding that. And I think my biggest advice would be not to wait to see a job advert, get there ahead of that job advert and reach out to the people you want to work with and tell them why they should hire you. And actually, sometimes the audacity of doing that will actually lead to roles, which is good.
Yeah, people like people who are proactive. Absolutely. Do you think that there's, I've seen it from my side, is AI destroying a little bit of the creative side of the theme park industry as well? Is that something you've seen? I mean, it looks to me like creative teams are amalgamating a bit, they're shrinking a little bit. Does that make it more competitive, or is there still plenty of opportunity, would you say?
In all honesty, I think it depends what field you are in the creative side of things. Now, there is certain elements of the creative process of designing an attraction, which is this, especially within Europe, we use a very kind of rigorous staged approach, and everything is in phases, and we go on to the next phase once things get signed off. It's a super rigorous process. There's certain elements of that, things like conceptual artists, for example. Now, AI is becoming really, really good at doing concept art. And there is certain roles that are struggling more than others. Things like feasibility studies and doing feasibility alignment, all of that type of thing. Now, it can do it to a certain extent, but actually you need the human logic to be able to say, actually, I learned this from the past 15 times of getting burned by a project. Now, AI is never going to learn that, right? AI cannot tap into your brain to say, oh, actually, you had a disaster on this project, and this is how you learned from it. This is how you moved on. So I definitely think there are probably some, there's some roles that are more, I'm going to say, at risk. But for me, technological advancements, and for me, this is new. This is kind of a new industrial revolution, right? We've been through it in the past, and for me, AI is a new form of industrial revolution that we're going through at the moment. You have to either harness it or work against it to really make yourself different and stand out away from the crowd. Do I use AI? I can use it to increase workflow, to help me keep on top of tasks and that kind of thing. I do not use it in my creative flow and my creative processes and the way that I deliver creative, the creative for attractions. The reason behind that is because, again, I've learned a lot over the past, the things that work, things that didn't work. You cannot input all of that information into a prompt to be able to deliver exactly what you're looking for. And I genuinely don't think it's going to get to a stage where you can do that. So I definitely think it is influencing the industry. I think there's a lot of people using it to increase the speediness of projects, delivery timelines of projects, which are notoriously getting smaller and smaller and smaller with every client that we deal with. But I don't think it's going to be at a position where it's going to really, really take over the industry. I think something drastic's going to have to change for that to happen.
Yeah. I suppose the thing with what you do, especially in the creative space in theme parks, is you're trying to generate an emotion in guests, whether you say that, whether that is fear or happiness or whatever. And AI is notoriously not good at emotions. So, but to tell an emotional story and put someone on that journey, that's going to be very difficult for it to do. That's really where you need a human to go, I know how to make another human feel like this.
Yeah, definitely. And I think emotion's the thing that is really separating and keeping it apart at this moment in time. I don't think it's going to get to a position where it will be able to really accurately have a cause and effect on emotion to know that actually by doing this, this is going to make them feel this way. It can guess, sure, it can guess. But actually, we're living human beings. We're going through that. We know that if this certain thing happens to me, this is how it makes me feel inside. And again, how that changes per age, right? So I don't think it's ever going to have the advantage because we are human, we feel. And no matter how many prompts you put in, it's never going to feel anything. So I definitely think we can keep on top, and that is our biggest USP. And I think if we start to all as creatives use that as our USP to really drive with emotion and drive with feeling, and a lot of the attractions that I design, the first kind of part of the package is how I want people to feel reading the book, not even just going in the attraction, but reading the document that I'm creating. This is what I want them to feel like during it. When we start to go to that level, that's when we know we're kind of safe from the AI generation.
Good. I don't want to see AI into our creative spaces. Like you said, I don't mind that it being used to speed up processes or to manage queue lines or something like that. Like, yeah, crack on. Let's make theme parks better for everyone with it. But it does make me sad when I start seeing it in the creative spaces. So, and on merchandise as well. Just hire a designer, guys. Come on. There's so
It
many
also
talented people.
just can't be trademarked. So people doing it on merchandise, you can't trademark AI. So technically, that piece of merchandise can be replicated by other people, and there wouldn't be a legal fight to do so. Again, I'm not recommending anybody does that because these people have very good lawyers. But it can't be trademarked. So that is also a bigger downfall to it.
Yeah, same with music as well, and Spotify, you have to label it as AI, and there's all kinds of issues with getting stuff uploaded. It's a minefield, but it's good to know that we've still got humans doing our theme park stuff at the moment. Let's take something like a scare maze, which obviously you have worked on at the start of your career. I don't go in scare mazes. Anyone who listens to the podcast regularly will know that. I am terrified of them. Ghost trains are beyond my limit as well. Where do you start with a scare maze? Do you generally get given a brief, like, we want it to be something supernatural, or we want it to be zombies, and then it's a blank slate, or is it literally do what you want, just terrify us?
Yeah, every client's different, really. A lot of it starts with my weird mind. I told you I was a weird kid.
Disturbed.
That's not gone. That's not gone. I'm just a weird adult now. Yeah, a lot of it depends. Sometimes the client comes with a really specific brief and says, usually what you tend to find is people who have an existing attraction with existing other attractions, scare mazes within them, usually come to you and say, actually, we need this theme or this kind of bracket of attraction because the other ones deliver these. So this one's got to deliver this, right? So sometimes we get that. Other times, when I've developed screen parks from scratch, we come up with the ideas and I kind of try to separate each of the different experiences. So a kind of really good example was when we was working on Screamland for the first year, which I believe was 2015. So it's when I used to work for the scare maze company. We were given the venue basically, and they were like, do whatever you want, like what can you come up with? So being based in Margate, I was like, I would love to do something seaside, truly seaside. So we developed a seaside story. It had a really good history. I don't know if you know much about Dreamland, but it started with a circus. It was a menagerie back in the day. So he's like, okay, we need that history being brought into it. And then the final attraction was it was set in an old cinema, and we was like, we need that into the narrative. So sometimes we take inspiration from the venue that we're doing that in. Other times, if it's a farm park, for example, that we're working with, a farm park hasn't really got a lot of heritage to it. A lot of the time, it was a farm. That's sometimes really hard to differentiate to different narratives. So what we tend to do with that is we'll go, okay, we know the demographic is 16 years of age to 25. That's what we're trying to aim at. what is the current trends? What are they going to like? We try to do trend forecasting to look into the future to see what horror films are coming up over the next couple of years and if there's like a trending theme, which there just tend to be. And we go, okay, well, one of the attractions should be this. If that one's paranormal, for example, that means we need to do something completely contrasting to that in another attraction that is not paranormal. So we need to do something that's based here and now about human against human rather than spirit against human. So then we'll have that. And then you've got really dark stories then. So you need something that contrasts to both of them, which lightens the mood a little bit to create this sort of ebb and flow of emotion. So then we have a look, and that's how we start to kind of put a diagram together about what these different themes should be. And then the narratives come on the back of that. So Scream's at Thornton Hall, which is a project we started 3 years ago, 4 years ago. That was the exact same. So we said we knew we wanted one to be based paranormal. And then to counteract that, we wanted something that was really visceral, gory, terrifying set now. So then we came up with Black Market, which is about humans being sold on the black market, and you went in alone, and there was a lot of like super interactive things that happened to you. I won't tell you too much about that. There's stories online that you can read. And then the
I
third
won't be
attraction was
going
that.
in, so
We'll get you free tickets. We'll get you down there.
you're right.
So the third option then, we was like, okay, we've got two quite dark storylines and narratives. So what do we do to lift it up? And then we wanted to do, the client wanted to do something to do with carnival or circus. But again, we've seen it so many times, and everything that I like to do, I like to put weird twists and quirk on things and just make things a little bit different that you wouldn't normally expect. So we set it during the Mardi Gras carnival. So the whole thing is about New Orleans culture. It's Mardi Gras. So it's still got a flavor of carnival, but it's comedic when you go through it. So there's a lot of like really funny things that are said to you, but it's terrifying when it happens. So we wanted these different kind of levels. Difficulty lies when you get Scream parks that have 10, 11, 12 attractions, because it's hard. There's only so many tropes in horror that you can follow and go down the route of. So I try to, as much as possible, when I work with clients, sort of stick to a maximum of like six separate scare mazes, because there is sort of six main tropes that you can go down the route of to make them all differentiate from one another. So that was a very long-winded answer, but yeah, it completely depends on the types of clients. I think at the kind of present time, there's about 100, I think I looked it up the other day, there's 165 scare mazes that I've kind of been part of in some way. And each one of them is different. Like every single one of them has a different narrative than the next one. So I'm getting to the point now where I'm like, oh, I've done that. I can't do that one again. So I'm going to have to pick something completely new. But the good thing is, horror is constantly evolving. There's new horrors that come into real world scenarios that we can kind of spin in a way that isn't actually glorifying horrific things that are happening in the world. But there's always something new to learn. There's always something new that scares people. Like AI, for example, that's been used in attractions for the past 2 years because it's a new prevalent thing that's happening. So it's always going to evolve as an industry. And I think that's what keeps me super excited by it.
Do you feel like audiences of scare mazes are sort of demanding things get scarier? Like, are people more immune to it now? So it's like, no, give me more. I want more gore. I want that's not scary enough. Something that would have been scary 10 years ago is now like, yeah, whatever.
Oh yeah, yes is the easy answer to that. I think because the industry is growing year on year, and more events are happening, more theme parks are growing their adult Halloween events, it's becoming really easy to compare yourself or your audience to compare you to the venue down the road. When I first started, there was sort of three or four, genuinely three or four big events in the UK. It was a really small industry, and now there is hundreds that happen every single year, and that's been in the space of what, 18 years or so now. And the growth that we've had is insane. Where that's led is that audiences know the industry now. Audiences know what to expect. Audiences are always expecting the next big thing to happen. And the problem is with that, the next big thing to happen is super expensive, right? It's got to be either tech infused. You've got to really think out the box to kind of create navigations that you've never seen before, which is really hard to do. So yeah, I think people are expecting more. What we're also finding is that the younger demographic, I'm not going to go super in depth with this because this is definitely a subject for a psychologist to come up with, but the younger demographic are becoming so desensitized at a young age that actually we're finding a lot of younger audiences are coming to these events now, whereas it used to be very much sort of 15, 14, 15 upwards that you used to find coming to these events. Some of the events that I've been part of, it's a recommended age of 15 or 16 plus, but it's a recommended age because I can't tell you what scares your child,
Yeah.
and equally they can't be the same to me, right? So we give a recommended age, and we've seen like 10-year-olds going through attractions, which is completely against what our guidelines are, but we've seen 10-year-olds going through attractions who are just not bothered and not fazed, and their parents are terrified, right? Their parents are screaming and crying coming out, and we're like, why is that? And we think there's like a pocket of age where the sort of twofold is this. This pocket of age where you don't understand threat or malice. All as you see is somebody in a costume jumping out at me, right? You don't see what that's portraying. You don't understand what threat that is. But the second part to this is because we are now, that generation is a digital generation. They're seeing horror on a daily basis coming through their phones at them, right? And it's so hard to safeguard against that.
Yeah.
But they're seeing that, and it's so accessible nowadays to see real horror that is happening in the world, that actually when they come to the attraction, they thought, oh, I'm not bothered about that because I saw a horrific video on TikTok. Even these scary makeup videos that happen, some of them are genuinely terrifying, right? And kids are seeing them going, oh, I love how she's done her eyeliner. And I'm like, how's that a thing? So I definitely think there's like an element now of children become desensitized. There's this like weird pocket where like the teenage demographic now are still a bit scared, but we're going to get to a point where it's going to be so hard to scare audiences. It's exciting, but it's quite terrifying as a designer in that field.
I think it's terrifying as a parent to think that you have got children as young as that who aren't scared by it, especially because I am someone who is so scared of any of it. I mean, honestly, I went on the ghost train at Blackpool and I come off crying. Like, everyone takes the mickey at me, but that is how sensitive I am to this kind of stuff. So yeah, it's really kind of worrying to think that we are getting so desensitized. Have you ever sort of come up with an idea and you're like, oh, that's really scary, but that it's almost too far, like I can't do that, the world isn't ready for that in a scare maze yet?
Funny story. So I get them quite often, and I kind of shelve them in a folder on my computer, and I'm like, it's such a call, like, maybe one day. That's my folder's name. Maybe one day. So I have a folder like that, and I kind of put ideas in when I've got them. Now, so I had an idea, talking about screams, and we mentioned Black Market. That was one of these ideas. So I had an idea probably around eight years ago now, and I was like, I really want to hang guests on meat hooks.
Oh god.
I want them to go through an attraction without controlling where they're walking, so there's a conveyor belt system like you see in abattoirs. I want that to be the experience that they walk, and they're guided through the experience. I really want to do it. And every client that I pitched to was like, nope, we are not doing that. And then when I met the Thornton Hall guys, I was like, we had to sit in this pitch meeting with the two owners and Tom, who's the event manager, who's brilliant. We sat in a meeting. I was like, Tom, do you think they're going to buy it? And Tom's from a scare background like I am. And we was like, yeah, let's pitch it, see how it sits. And we looked at Chris and Emma, who won the attraction. We looked at them, and their faces kind of just went and dropped. And I was like, is that a good sign? Is that a bad sign? And they went, yeah, let's do it. Let's try it. It's unique. Let's try it. And actually, it was the saving grace for us to do that attraction. And it's got such a kind of weird following now, and people really love it, and they come and see the next iterations and chapters and things. And the team are doing a really good job in terms of like keeping that momentum up with new chapters of the story. But that was one of their ideas. I was like, no one's ever going to buy this. I just want to do it. And then eventually a client went, let's do it.
Yeah. And that's the evolution of time as well, isn't it? That 8 years ago, maybe it was way too shocking to even consider, but now it's like, no, okay, that's on the edge of what's acceptable. That makes me scared for the future, honestly. like I said, not that I'm going in any of them. Moving kind of on from scare mazes then, obviously you have, it's not just scare mazes you do, you work on themed attractions. I know you did a big area at Camel Creek. Was that one of your first sort of big projects that you were like, okay, I get to own this and really do what I want?
Yeah, it was a really cool project. So we did the Land of Myths and Legends. So we were contacted by Camel Creek at the time, who said, we need a new attraction, or we need several new attractions. We need something to stand out. But again, budgets in the UK theme park industry are tighter than a lot of people think. So he's like, okay, well, what can we achieve by it? They already had an existing roller coaster that was on site. They had a cafe that was on site. And I was like, okay, let's have a look and see what we can do. One of the attractions we aim to be like an upsell opportunity. So I'm super excited to work on it, and we work with the team really, really well. We designed a whole new area around myths and legends based in Cornwall, because obviously it's just on the outskirts of Padstow. So it's got a really rich heritage of folklore and myths and legends, and we wanted to bring it to life. So we developed it, and the turnaround was tight for this to come in. They kind of got funding quite last minute for this to be built. So we built a whole new climbing structure, play frame, which is huge. And we built a mini golf course, which is themed to shipwrecks and pirates. But it was based on Cornish stories that we did. The play structure was based on Arthur and King Arthur and Merlin. But it was all infused in with like a passport in the area. So there was loads of like games and extra level of things that you could do free as a guest in the park. That was all built in with the play structure, and it's still there existing now. We rethemed the roller coaster for them, and then we did a big indoor play area and a cafe called The Hidden Garden, and we completely transformed that space. Like they were saying, especially from a financial perspective, the cafe wasn't doing particularly well. It was a bit of a drab space to be in. People didn't want to be in there, but it has now like fully interactive lighting. It's got soft play in there. It's all really themed like a hidden garden. It's quite dark and moody in there, and it's worked really well to kind of have that uplift for them. But it was such a cool project to be part of, and it was a big expanse of space. Like it was a huge project. There were a lot of people involved in it, but I was kind of creatively overseeing and directing that. I did the kind of branding for them, come up with all the branding and signage designs for them, as well as kind of liaising with all the external suppliers to make sure everything was kind of going through the same path. But yeah, it was a super exciting project to work on, and I still work with the team now. I just delivered an attraction for them based on Bing and Flop, who are the two characters in the UK. So I just did the Bing and Flop Animal Corner walkthrough for them, which was a really cute project to be part of as well, working with a new IP that I've never worked with before. So that was a really nice little project as well. So I love working with these sort of small to medium sized businesses, and the UK is really good for that because everyone wants to work together, and they're really good at sharing information between each other as well, which is it's good for me because I kind of get my name shared between them, and I get to work with them, which is super exciting.
I think we are seeing this in our smaller parks. Obviously, Camel Creek is a small theme park, but that's quite a big investment in a themed area for them to do all of that you've just said. And maybe before they would have just gone, oh, the roller coaster's fine, we don't need to theme it. So, do you think there is an appetite from the smaller parks as well to really try and step up and become more immersive and try and not compete with the big brands, but do what they can to make the experience better for guests?
Yeah, definitely. I think I think there's a big shift in trend, I think, in the UK market over the past couple of years. Now, there's obviously big giga projects that are being announced left, right, and centre for the UK. There's been sort of two really big ones announced over the past year. But these have been rumbling in the industry for a long, long time. Like people knew these big things were happening, especially operators knew these things were happening. So people have been kind of like leveling up very slowly over time. I think Paulsens is a really, really good example. Like the work and the level of the sheer level of creativity and work that they've put in over the past couple of years, is incredible. And I think a lot of the smaller parks are looking at the likes of Paulsens, who are really kind of leading the way in terms of that small to medium-sized business. Even though they are a large operator in the UK, they're looking at them and go, actually, we want to start doing that. Yeah, we've got a smaller budget, but how can we develop something similar? How can we look at an area? How can we work with people to develop more of a narrative within a space? And how can we kind of build that up? There's a lot more people looking at that now and finding it more important, whereas it used to be a case of people go, oh, I've bought a roller coaster, I'll shove it there, I'll call it this, it's fine. People are now thinking at a more granular level about how that actually looks. How's that marketed? How's that narrative told before guests come here? How can we kind of pitch that way before they come here to bring them in? And the industry is competitive. Like, there's a lot of theme parks in the UK that say, we've got a new ride this year, come to this. How do you make your new ride on your area stand out from the people down the road? And I think by telling a narrative, branding it really cleverly towards the target audience, and looking at things like IPs and how you can associate with IPs to kind of bring that footfall in there as well, I think more people are looking towards that.
Oh, I mean, Portland's is a park. Again, we've had Lawrence on the podcast twice. It's a park that I love. I think they are doing incredible things and showing how, a family-owned theme park can really step up. But just down the road from Portons is Creeley, and Josh has been on as well. And that's a park that you've done a load of work with this year. And we talked about it when Josh was on and how I felt it was a level up for them with Pirates Plummet and Rota, which has just opened, in terms of the branding and the look and feel of those rides. And you're the guy who is behind that.
Yeah, so it's... I will say it's definitely a team effort. I'm going to kind of pop that out straight away. It was really exciting. I think I've worked with Josh now for many years. Another business that I used to work for. I used to work for an entertainment company who did some sort of seasonal activations for him, which were great, went down really well. And then Josh and I have kind of kept in touch ever since. And then he reached out probably about a year ago, maybe a bit before that, and said, "We're thinking about buying this ride." It started with one ride. So I'll tell you kind of story. I'm sure Josh has told me the same thing, but started with one ride and then he procured the ride. Really good, really, really good investment for them, obviously from Portons. And then what tends to happen in this industry is you hear of things, people go, have you heard about that warehouse in the Middle East that's got all of those rides in there? And everyone goes, oh, what is happening there? And I just got wind of this ride that was for sale, which was the Zampella Air Race. So as we were working on the design for Pirates Plummet, he's like, "I've got a new ride coming as well." I was like, "Oh, another one?" I was like, "For the year after?" He's like, no, it's opening this year too." So he's like, will you work on that with us as well?" So that's a really cool process as well with that team, because Jody and the marketing team have such a strong vision on what they want to create, what they want to develop. And so kind of my role within it isn't to actually do the brand work specifically. What I did with them is kind of like brand workshops to say, how about this direction, and then I worked on the sort of 3D mock-ups, how it will look in situ, how will the theming look, how will the brand look like, what could the ride be painted like, all of that kind of stuff. So I worked with them as a kind of creative insight with them. I get to work with their team in that way, so with Josh and the marketing team, and it's really good fun. Like they're such a nice team to work with and super easy going, so it was really good to work with them in that. And it was also great just to work on two new thrill rides for the UK at the same park in the same year. Like it was a really good project to work with. And at the same time, I was working with Black Gang Chime to do their new ride this year as well. So it's been a really good year. I think there's been a lot of nice projects that I've been working on, and the two at Creeley just really stand out as well. They're super, super fun attractions, and they're going down really well. I'm sure Josh has told you as well, but the audience love them. I think it's a really exciting thing that the park's doing. I'm super excited to see where they go in the future as well.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, Black Hand China as well. All these sort of southwest coastal parks, like doing big things this year, it has been great for them. I think Rota in particular impressed me because it didn't follow the normal theme that you'd expect for a Zampella Air Race. So was that you thinking, no, we can't just do, we don't want it to be planes, you know, just like normal aeroplanes, we've got to do something different with it?
So I can't claim this one. I wish I could. I love the vehicles, and I when Josh sent me the photos, I was like, yes, buy it. I was like, this looks great. So I'm sure he's probably told you a story, but in essence, there was the ride was developed for another park. In Asia, the park didn't go ahead, so there is a warehouse full of an entire park worth of rides, and the park didn't go ahead, and Josh saw it and was like, I want to buy that ride because it's such a really nice stylist, but it really works with the Creeley brand. Like it was just the right thing at the right time. It was the right fit. I remember sending photos, he was like, this is what it looks like. I was like, yeah, I think it worked really well. And then we went over loads of different ideas of how that can fit in with the narrative. So usually what we would do is work the other way. We'd say, this is the theme, this is the narrative, kind of go through that design process. With this one, we'd have to work opposite and go, okay, this is what it looks like. So how can we build a narrative behind that? How can we build a storyline behind that? How can we kind of do that? So we had to work kind of back to front with it. Usually we would work with the manufacturers to say, this is what we want the chassis to look like. This is what we want everything to look like. And then kind of go through that process. But we had to work the opposite way. But actually it worked out really well for us because we knew it was so stylized and heavily stylized that we knew the direction straight away that we wanted to go in, and about this inventor and kind of how we could build all of that in with it, about invention and innovation. And it just worked really well, especially because it's super innovative for the Southwest, right? It's the first inverting ride there. So it's a big thing, and it kind of all just snowballed into one and kind of just wrote itself to some extent. But yeah, I think it's such a beautiful, beautiful ride. It's really stunning.
Yeah, it looks great. I mean, they're always impressive rides when you watch them off-ride anyway. But yeah, I think that one in particular, it is beautiful. And like you say, the perfect fit for Creeley and doing good things for them, no doubt. So where are you up to now? So you've been doing all these projects, creative things. Are you working with a theme park at the moment? Or what? Can you tell us what you're working on at the moment?
I can tell you a little bit.
I know you creators are always really secretive about what you're working on.
Honestly, I'm up to my eyeballs in NDAs. That's all it is.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Got a file full of non-disclosures. So yeah, I'm working on some really exciting things at the moment. Truth be told, again, I work full time as well as the creative work that I do. So I'm really busy with live business, and I'm the director of business development. So we are very, very heavy with entertainment concepts at the moment. Very, very busy in river cruise, hotels, resorts. And then the design side of things, I am currently working on some branded IP-led family entertainment centers that are currently being built in Latin America, Northern America, and Europe. So there's a huge expansion plan, without kind of saying too much, there's a huge expansion plan for some branded FECs, family entertainment centers, and I'm currently kind of working with the team to develop what that could be, and again from a live business perspective, how can entertainment work in that, and kind of working through that. So it's a super exciting time, and I can't do them enough justice. They are mini indoor theme parks in essence. They're really cool. They're super exciting projects to work on, but every time I jump in a call, there's another one that's been added to the list. So there's quite a few of them in the expansion plan, which is a great, great position to be in. But it's super exciting to see where it's up to. And I'm very excited to see them come to UK shores, especially because it's very different from anything we have over here.
Yeah, I was going to say, please, can we get some in the UK? Or at least one would be great with our climate. Just something that you can go to, like, oh, it's indoors. Of course it's going to be fine. We don't need to worry about the weather.
Yeah, it's in the plan. It's in the plan.
Oh, that's very exciting. And obviously we've got a huge development on the horizon in the UK with Universal coming. As a creative, that must be exciting for you to see, even if you're not, you know, directly involved with it at the moment, at least. What would you like to see Universal bring to the UK theme park scene? What do you think it's going to do for you?
I'm so excited by it, because I've mentioned Universal before. I adore Universal. Like, Universal is the reason, as a brand, I'm in the industry. And what is really beautiful is I'm getting to see a lot of like friends and people that I've worked with in the past or connections on LinkedIn. I'm getting to see them get these incredible jobs. And I know it's in super safe hands, and it's so exciting to see.
Yeah.
I think for me, what I would love is how the Universal brand is spanned for a British audience. I think in terms of, we are very different to a US audience, right? Even from a price point perspective, from all of that, I'm super excited to see kind of how there is a British spin on the Universal product and how that is delivered. And if that means new IPs that are brought in that are more fitted to UK audiences, or that are rooted in UK history, without naming any IPs, I think that'd be super exciting. There's obviously been rumours out there about certain IPs that are potentially being looked at or kind of hired in. And I'm really excited to see that. If that happens, I think that's going to be so cool to see something new from a Universal product that nobody's seen ever before, and we get it in the UK. I 100% am going to get an annual pass. The moment it opens, my annual pass is coming straight to the door. I will be there every day, that annoying person. I'm just super excited. And I think, like I said, there's a lot of incredible talent working on it. They have been working on it for months, if not years.
Yeah.
And I'm super excited to see what they do with it, because there is just some incredible people working on it, and it's going to be, it's genuinely going to change the industry as we know it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And hopefully for the better, and hopefully you've already seen the other smaller parks starting to step up, knowing things like Universal are on the horizon, and it's going to be good for everyone, and I'll be elbowing you out the way on opening day at the, at the front gate. Do you think it's easier to work with an IP as a creative, or is that more difficult? Would you rather have a blank slate, or if they say, right, it's got to be, let's just say, Minions themed, does that help you?
It's such a double-edged sword, I think, working with IPs. Like, I've been really fortunate. I've worked with Netflix, Warner Brothers, Paramount, Middle Earth Enterprises, that I've worked with quite a few different brands and IPs, and each one of them comes with the pros, cons. I think as a creative, sometimes challenge is really enticing. So actually, the more challenging an IP is, sometimes that's actually more enticing than working, coming up with an IP yourself, right? I think I love coming up with narratives. I'm a storyteller at heart. I love coming up with new stories and kind of developing an IP from scratch. But there is nothing more exciting than working on an IP when you know millions of people follow that IP. And when it gets announced, you're like, I've worked on that, even though you're not allowed to tell anyone. I worked on that. I was part of that. And it's really exciting. I think for me, I love working with IP. I really love working with different properties and brands. And being able to take sometimes what is visual media that we only look at on TV, or whether it's an audiobook or a storybook, being able to actually develop that into a real functional 3D space is so, so exciting to be able to do. And you're the first that's done that in some respects a lot of the time. And I really love that. I really love being able to kind of create these worlds where people are genuinely walking through an environment that they've only seen on screen. And it's just, for me, it's magical, and it's really hard to actually do that any other time.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know, because I never sort of knew if it would be frustrating for a creative to be kind of bound by the rules of an IP, but it's good to hear.
It can be.
Yeah. I want to use a different shade of yellow. It's been so great chatting to you, Mark. There will be people listening to this thinking, he's got my dream job, without giving away your job. What would you say to someone who is listening going, I've got to do this. This is where I want to be. How do you start?
For me, it's, even if it means you're working on personal projects for your portfolio is key in this industry. I think there's two things really, portfolio and connections. It's, a lot of people obviously talk about who you know and kind of everything to do with that, but this industry is the biggest example of, you get to where you're going by knowing people. It's such a connected industry. It's super close-knit. Even though it's so vast, everyone talks to one another. There's so many networking events that happen. Getting yourself out there, which can often be uncomfortable for a lot of people. Now, most of my job is going to networking meetings. Do I like it? No. But you've kind of got to push yourself to do it, right? And sometimes stepping out of your comfort zone to go to networking meetings just to meet people and put your face out there, put who you are in front of these people is so important. I cannot recommend it enough, that you will get somewhere if you've got the passion for the industry, you love what you do, and you will start pushing yourself and networking yourself. You will get to where you need to go. I think learning as much as possible as well. You've got to absorb as much as possible. Listen to people, ask people for mentorships. There's so many really, really incredible people who are really at the top of their game in the industry, who, if you jump on a message to them on LinkedIn and go, listen, I love what you do, please can I spare 20 minutes of your time just to ask you these questions? They will say yes. Most of the people love to talk about the role that they're doing and how they got into it and why they got into it. Don't be scared about reaching out and just asking people for a bit of guidance as to how they do certain things. Or even if you're stuck on a project and you don't know how to overcome it, ask somebody for help. I think communication is just key. That's kind of the biggest thing I will say.
Yeah. And you're right. From my experience of speaking to people at all levels within the industry, they are so generous with their time, and they are more than happy to talk about how they got into it, how they can help you get into it. It is a very open industry in that way. No one's really gatekeeping it. Mark, before you jump off, I've got one final question for you.
Just gotta ride it.
I do this every time I have a guest on the podcast. This is Just Gotta Ride It. Imagine a world, if you have to, where every roller coaster is about to get destroyed. You can only save one. Which one are you going to protect with your life? And it's only one. Well, I've had people try and shoehorn in a couple of other ones. It's one.
Start off races.
Oh, yes. Thank you. That's my current number one.
I adore it. Like, it's... I've never... when I was at IAPA last year, a friend of mine who works for Holovis, Ben Fry, big shout out to Ben, me and him were sat next to each other on it, and it hit the brake run, and our faces was the funniest thing. We just looked at each other in pure joy and excitement. Yeah. And we were like, that's good. That's a really good ride. And then we just went on it so many times that evening, and I love it. Like, I love that ride. So that'll be the one that's safe.
It is such a magical experience. And on paper, it's not doing anything that roller coasters haven't really done before, but there's just something about it. And I can't describe it. And I don't know if you have the same experience of riding it at night as well. It just takes it to another level. Those trains are just beautifully lit. And there is an example of an immersive experience that's been created actually without a load of theming. You're not going into, yeah, you know, big themed elements or anything like that, but you are racing a comet, and that's what we're doing. And
I think for me, backseat on the green side, forgive me, I forget which one that is called, but backseat on the green side of the track is just God level tier. It is just a phenomenal. Seeing the other train like wrap around you and, yeah, the kind of floating element where you got, it's just phenomenal. Plus the airtime on it is so strong. I'm an airtime fan, and you just hit the brake running, you're like, okay, I feel like I've been to the gym. It's such a good ride. I adore it.
Yeah, I'm fully with you on that one. So that is safely locked away in my Just Gotta Ride It safe. It is phenomenal. If you haven't ridden it, you do need to get out to Orlando and get that on your bucket list. Absolutely. Mark, it's been fantastic having you. Thank you for coming on, giving us some of your time, some of your insights. Will you be at IAPA Expo in a couple of weeks in London?
Yes, I'll be there and attending any networking event that happens. So you will see me around. Definitely, we'll go and grab a coffee. We'll have a catch up about Stardust Races.
We'll be talking, just going, oh my god!
We'll have a geek session about Stardust. But yeah, I'll definitely be at IAPA, and then hopefully I'm going to be at IAPA Orlando as well. So
awesome! Like I said, thank you for giving us your time. I know it's been really interesting to me. I'm sure it has to everyone listening as well. If you haven't already, hit subscribe. That way you never miss an episode whenever I release one. And if you'd like to leave a review, tell me what you think. I always appreciate that as well. Until next time, though, we've been Parkcast.
Parkcast. The UK's original theme park podcast.